on the front line of freedom. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with Carl Heuser of Cayucas, California, originally from Paso Robles. And on August 4th, 1944, he was in Gosfield, England, where he volunteered to take the place of a sick turret gunner and fly that day as part of a three-man A-20 crew with the 644th Squadron, 410th Bomb Group. What a fateful decision that was. You heard Carl describe the jolt when he pulled his parachute while bailing out that day. But I really want to understand, and I want our listeners to understand, what this whole experience was like. So let's explore a little more, if we can.
How you guys got hit. I'm assuming it was anti-aircraft artillery that got you. Did you know it was coming, or were you guys just blindsided? How'd that happen?
You could see and smell the bursting of the anti-aircraft shells. And you could smell it, but you just kept right on flying. The German anti-aircraft was very accurate at our level. We were only about 10 or 11,000 feet, and very accurate there. And we lost a lot of planes because of that. But because we had to fly that level so that our bombing was more accurate. And we were bombing bridges and railroads and things like this, and troops. But we didn't bomb the factories like the heavies did. They bombed all the strategic factories, the ball bearing factories. But we would bomb bridges and railroads and things like that. Bomb dumps. That about from about 10,000. But when we got rid of those bombs, we turned around and go, oh, yeah. I mean, we went home in a hurry. It was always across the channel. There was nothing ahead of time to warn us. And it just, we knew that there was, you could see them, and you'd fly right through them. The bursts of the black smoke. You'd fly right through it, but sooner or later there would be one for you. And sure enough, it just picked us right out of the center of the squadron, just took the whole tail off of our airplane. And like I said, the gunner down with Fred, who was down below, he had his camera, and the camera was just blown out of his head. But that's what kept him from getting killed. Otherwise, that blast would have killed him. His flak suit looked like somebody had taken a shotgun about 5 feet away and just shot at him. My, I was in pretty good shape when I got there. I was not wounded, but like I said, I spent as little time as I could in the air. But the Germans were there waiting for me when I came down. They were right there on the ground. The same people that shot us down, by the way. So,
oh, really?
Yeah, they were pretty proud of us. They marched us into town. They let us keep our shoes on, but they took all the rest of our paraphernalia off, all the military stuff, and took that off.
So you and the gunner landed somewhere near the same spot?
He landed about 2 miles from where I did, because he was high, he was up higher. The wind blew him that way. But I landed. I came right down in the middle of where the anti-aircraft battery was, the camp. I was right close to that. I came right down there. But then they brought us together, and they marched. The German officer that came had a motorcycle. We didn't see any trucks until later on after they captured us. This is kind of funny. They put us into the basement of a home and took all of our clothes off. Everybody took us stark naked, and then they marched us upstairs to stand in front of this officer's desk. He was going to interrogate us. And here I'm standing there stark naked, and this guy's playing with my .45, my gun. And I knew it was loaded because I had a shell in the chamber. And I'm telling him, you stupid so-and-so, that gun is loaded. You better let me take care of it. And the guards are poking me in the back with their rifles. The adrenaline was really flowing because I didn't have any fear at all about hurting him. But I had to tell him. So he finally handed me my .45 and let me take it apart. And I took all the shells out and put it back on the desk. But that was a funny thing.
What was going through your mind as you floated down to the ground, got captured, get taken to be interrogated, all that? I mean, I'm sure you never expected to be in that situation. So what was it like when you were? Were you just kind of shocked? What were you feeling?
You thought about what you did when certain things would happen. You always had to sort of presuppose things and so on. But I had never thought about what would happen if I got shot down. I was not going to get shot down. So there it comes, and I'm doing it. And I can only remember very vaguely the thoughts that went through my head. I said, damn it, the war's over for you. You're not going home after any 65 missions. Then, of course, I could also say that I was glad to be alive. I got a good story to tell you. In prison camp, in our camp, we were all in bed. There was a lot, just oodles of us. There were over 8,000 of us in Soligloff 4. And we'd go out and have a parade every day. Every morning I had a parade. As soon as we'd get up, they'd count us. The Germans could only count by fives, so we had to line up by fives. So they had given us a parcel when we got for it. Had a sweater in it and some shorts and socks and toothpaste and so on. And anyhow, I had a box of a can of brown shoe polish. I wonder why they wanted us to shoe polish. And now, we had a guy in our room, his name was Beatty. And Beatty came from Tonawanda, New York. And he was always telling stories. He was funnier than hell. Anyhow, he went around to everybody and convinced them all to paint a brown Hitler mustache with that shoe polish. And our whole barracks did that. Well, we fell out as usual. And the German guard did not know how to handle this. They run back and forth. Usually this would take about 5 or 10 minutes. It took us 20 minutes. They said, stay right here. And then they went, the commandant, our commandant came. And he said, what's the matter? And he laughed. And, you know, they said, go back to your barracks. So the German guards then went to the barracks, and they convinced the commandant, the German commandant. We had heard good feelings about him. He had been an ME-109 pilot shot down in Africa and been sent to America for medical treatment, and he was back again. He was a tall guy, very imposing. I mean, he was a real typical, if you want to say a typical German officer, this was him. So he came in, and here we're lined up again, all with our mustaches. And I still think I saw a smile on his face. But he's told you. But anyhow, they chatted for about 5 or 10 minutes. Okay, everybody back there, but no more facial paintings, no more face paintings. Okay, so we won't paint any more Hitler mustaches on. That was funny. We had to make our own fun.
Well, yeah, you had to make your own a lot of things, from what I understand from all the POWs I've interviewed. How difficult was it to be in those conditions, whether it was the weather, the lack of proper food, the uncertainty of the whole thing, not knowing when you're ever going to get out of there? How did you deal with all of that?
Everybody had their own feelings about what was going to happen to them. We didn't know, we didn't have any idea how the Germans were going to treat us or mistreat us. We were all apprehensive. We thought, well, you know, they could mistreat us, but they did not mistreat us. The only thing they didn't do, they didn't feed us, but they did not mistreat us.
No, and you were there for a while, all the way until February 1945, when they marched you out of there to avoid the incoming Russians.
We were the last people to get out, I think, really. And it was snow. It was one of the worst winters they'd had back there. And we took our blankets, so that's all we had. Sleep three together. And I had had a blood poisoning on my foot. I stepped on a piece of glass, and I got an infection in my foot. And that foot was still... It was healing because the doctor had healed it up, but it was still warm from fever. And everybody that put their feet, all their feet against my one foot to keep their feet warm when we sleep. We slept on the snow many times at night, and you did a lot of rolling around. You didn't sleep an awful lot. But then the next morning you get up and you know, get going again. The Germans had dogs that they had with them pretty quick. Their dogs were all of our good friends. We could pet them and stuff. That march, almost 3 months, 88 days we marched. We would go from town to town. Some days we'd march 30 kilometers. Some days we'd march 5 kilometers. They just did not know what to do with us except to keep us away from the Russians. That was their main, because they were scared stiff of the Russians for good reason. You know, the Russians were entirely different kind of soldiers than the Germans were. As I said, the Germans did not abuse us. They just didn't feed us.
Let's expound on that for a minute if you can, because some people who've heard this show and heard other POWs might have an idea of what that was like. But let me just ask you a few questions. How much do you think you weighed when you were captured?
Less than 100 pounds. I must have weighed maybe close to, I had my regular weight at that time about 145 pounds. And I know my belt was, I could tell, not my belt, probably weighed about 90 pounds when I was liberated. We lost a lot of weight.
Well, and for you, a lot of that was due to the march too, but just in the camp itself, I'm sure you started losing weight. What all did they feed you? Are we talking about the infamous bread you need a power saw to cut through, or what were you eating?
The German rations in camp with a bucket full of potatoes per room, and they had to be scraped, not peeled. They had to be scraped, and then they would go back and cook them, and then get them back in for lunch. And a bucket full of potatoes and a piece of, well, like pumpernickel bread, about maybe an inch and a quarter thick, and a pat of butter on top of that. And that was the German ration. That's what the Germans gave us. We had Red Cross parcels, and they would dole them out to us as they wanted to. But that was what I saved it, because we would get, every day we get a different can. You had to turn in, if you turned in 20 cans, if you got 20 cans, you had to turn in 20 cans, so you couldn't keep any cans. So, but every day was a little bit something different. Red Cross parcels were very, very helpful. That's why some people don't like the Red Cross too much, but they were the people that got that stuff to us. So, I remember I wrote a letter to Ann Landers, because she had taken on the Red Cross for some reason. I said, don't forget what they did for us. They were the ones that got it to us. That was important.
I've heard some stories over the years, different things that guys did with some of those cans or materials they'd get from the Red Cross, and pretty improvisational ways that they used different materials, whatever they could get their hands on. Do you think back on anything you saw in your camp, whether you made or someone else made, that you never would have thought of that?
After the camp froze over, this is December now, and the big parade ground is all frozen over, the Germans had poured water on it. So the guys would take the skin from a Klim can and try to make skis, trying to put, not skis, but skates on their shoes. And they were falling and tumbling around out there. It was kind of funny to watch, because nobody was going to make a pair of skates out of a tin can, but they tried. I'm sure the Germans were eating very well, too, because they were eating our parcels also, and they had thousands of them. They had tons of them.
Did you hear from home at all? Did they hear from you at all?
They were given two letters and four postcards every month to write. I never got anything from them. I think very few of the guys in our camp got any mail back. That was hard. Now, remember, it was August the 4th when I was shot down. Excuse me. My parents probably had a letter or two after that, but they did not know what happened to me until January. I was there. I wasn't even thinking about that. But when I got home, I thought, boy, that was a long time not to know anything. I've still got the cables from the government.
And I want to understand what life was like in that camp. And like you said, everyone had a little different perspective there. But when you look back at the time you spent in captivity, do you see something that helped you get through that? Was there something about your mindset, your faith, your confidence? How did you survive all that in the face of so many things that would make people want to give up?
We supported each other. I think that's the prime feature of this. When we saw a guy starting to get a little bit, he's on his way, we would gather up together and take care of him. We'd walk with him. We would give him extra, some of our food, if necessary. But anyhow, we were going to make damn sure that nobody in our care went off the deep end. And I think we all knew that we were going to win the war. We knew we were going to, it doesn't matter when. We all knew that we just had to do what we had to do to stay alive, to stay there. Like I said, it was just making sure that nothing happened to me, because nothing's going to happen to you.
How did you guys, inside your camp, keep up with what was going on outside your camp? Did you have any idea of how close the end of the war was getting?
We had a logger. There were four loggers. The first logger was made up with mostly the British troops, and the British had a radio. They would call it the Gash. Every day, somebody from the British compound would go up to on sick call, and then he would spread the gas to the guys. The German guard, there were not enough of them to take care of us, so we had plenty of room there. And only, you see, the doctors were our American surgeons, American flight surgeons. They would tell the guy, and then this guy would come back to his logger and go from barracks to barracks and tell them what yesterday's news was. And so we knew the pretty what was going on in the war, because we had the British had, they had bamboozled a German guard to bring him the pieces they had to. If you'd ask a German guard for a match and he gave him a match, you had something on him. He was not supposed to give you that match. So you had something on him, and you said, I'm going to tell. And so they were very careful. But it was funny in that way. You could bribe them with food or cigarettes. They liked our cigarettes, but they had more of our cigarettes than we did.
And you already referenced the march, the infamous march, the march that claimed a lot of lives, thankfully not yours. How did that come about? I'm sure you weren't expected to be taken out of your barracks and marched halfway across the continent.
As I said, our camp was up in Poland, and the Russians were coming close. The Russians were coming from the east towards the west, and the Germans had no right, no use at all for the Russians. They were scared stiff of the Russians. And so they, as I said, they marched us out 1,000 a day, and we were one of the last groups that went out there, but they gave us a parcel of food to take with us, and we had our blankets and so forth, and we just had to go as we went. And like I said, it was the first part of February, and this is one of the worst winters that they had had in Northern Europe, and it was a bitter, bitter winter, bitter cold, and three of us would gather together, and we would just hug each other to try to stay warm at night. As we went on and the weather got better, then we began to read each other's shirt sleeves and so forth for lice. We had lice. And we had the same clothes on for 3 months. We didn't change anything. A lot of us had dysentery, and our pants were dirty, and we couldn't do a thing about it. We had to keep on going. And we had GI shoes, and that's one thing that I had. I traded my GI shoes with a Moroccan kid. He was in the next compound, and we talked to him, and he said he would give me a can of Spam to trade my shoes. He had British shoes. So he threw his shoe over one of his, I threw my shoe over, and then he threw me a can of Spam over and threw another shoe. So I had a can of Spam and his shoes. His shoes had hobnails in the heels. They were well made. They were British. They were well made. But, miserable hawk talking with, instead of rubber, hobnails on your heels. So I had to wear those for the last month or so that I had. My feet were pretty well tired.
And on that march, and I don't know if people can really fathom marching for that long and for that many miles. I'm sure there were guys that were getting weak and couldn't keep up. What happened to someone who just couldn't keep going?
Occasionally, and this only happened, I would say, 12, 15 times. If a guy had to fall out of the formation, a guard had to go with him. And very often, you'd hear a one shot and the guard would come back alone. because the guy he couldn't make it anymore. The guard knew it, he knew it, and they just leave him there. They would when we get to a little town, if they had some people that were sick, we talk to the German guards and tell them, and they would try to make arrangements there to have someone look after you in the little town. So several of our guys bailed out that way. They stayed in the little town where the Germans were taking medical care of them.
What a desperate situation you found yourself in. And, you know, I think this a lot during these programs, if I don't always verbalize it, but I think I will here. I absolutely cannot imagine what that must have felt like. I know people have asked you plenty over the years, I'm sure, Carl, about the possibility of escape. So let's talk about that when we come back. Carl Heuser of Cayucas is our guest today. We'll get the rest of his incredible and emotional story when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. The average age of the veterans on this program is pretty close to 90, so I've seen firsthand over the years the challenges of aging, and I've realized that everybody approaches them a little differently. For some, a friendly senior living community is the ideal option, but for many of us, there's no place like home. I don't have any ruby slippers for you, but I do have an idea. Call Jason Selsler at 317 Construction, recognized by the National Association of Home Builders as a certified age-in-place specialist. Instead of giving up the comforts of home, why not let 317 Construction make your home more comfortable by making it more accessible? Jason and his crew can widen doorways, install ramps for wheelchairs or scooters, reconfigure your counters for better access, modify your shower for safety, secure grab bars wherever you need them, whatever it takes to allow you and your family to keep making your memories in the place that holds so many of them, your home sweet home. Call 905-8490. That's 559-905-8490.
If you are a World War II veteran and you have not been to the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C., Honor Flight wants to take you there free of charge. The sooner you submit an application, the sooner Honor Flight can get you to your memorial. In Kern County or the Central Coast, call Lily Marsh at 661-544-VETS. That's 661-544-VETS. Or go to honorflightkernCounty.org. For Fresno, Madera, Merced, Mariposa, Kings, or Tulare counties, check out CV Honor Flight, CV as in Central Valley, CVHonorFlight.org, or call Al Perry at 559-970-9853. That's 559-970-9853. Maybe you're the son or daughter of a veteran and you'd like to go along as a guardian. There are applications for that too, and there are other ways you can help. Donations to Honor Flight are tax deductible. We all owe our freedom and liberty to the men and women who put their lives on the line for it. Let's all come together now behind Honor Flight and give our veterans one more tour with honor.